Jairad Hamadava Kunjabi Hari. Jairad Hamadava Kunjabi Hari. Gopi Janabalaba Kirit Bhadadari. Gopi Janabalaba Kirit Bhadadari. Yashoda Nandana Raja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Raja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Raja Jana Ranjana. Jamuna Tira Banachari. Jamuna Tira Banachari. Jairad Hamadava Kunjabi Hari. Jairad Hamadava Kunjabi Hari. Jaya Gopi Janabalaba Girit Bhadadari. Jaya Gopi Janabalaba Girit Bhadadari. Yashoda Nandana Raja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Raja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Raja Jana Ranjana. Jamuna Tira Vanachari. Jamuna Tira Vanachari. Jairad Hamadava Kunjabi Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Jaya Gopi Jana Balaba Girit Bhadadari. Jaya Gopi Janabalaba Girit Bhadadari. Yashoda Chandana, Prajajana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana, Prajajana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana, Prajajana Ranjana. Jamuna Tira Banachari. Jamuna Tira Banachari. Jai Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Jai Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jayam Shipavam Sapadada Jagachai Stuadis Sisima AC Bhakti Vedanta Samiraj Prabhupada Ki Jayam Shibam Sabadana Jikasaso Jesse Simad Bhakti Siddhanta Sassi Dagor Slavrupaki Anantakoti Vaishnaviniki Skan Founder Charles Slavrupaki Nama Charles Haridasa Goki Frames the Goes because the Jaitanya Bunatan and the Siadwaita Gadara Sivasi Go Bhaktaviniki Sisi Radha Krishna Kobubina Shamakun Radakun Giddigobadanki Vrindavan Damki Navaritamki Ganga Maiki Yamuna Maiki Tulasi Deviki Bhakti Deviki Samaveta Bhakta Vrindaki Gaur Premanandi. All glories to some of the devotees. All glories to some of the devotees. All glories to some of the devotees. All glories to Sisi Guru Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 18, text number 9, 8. Angushta matram amalang spurat purata maulinam apivya darshanam shamam tadid vasasam achyutam angushta matram amalam spurat purata maulinam Apivya darshanam shamam tadidvasasam achyutam angushta matram amalam spurat puratamolinam apivya darshanam shamam tadidvasasam achyutam Angushta matram amalam spurat purata maulinam apivya darshanam shamam tadidvasasam achyutam
Angushta matram amalam
Angushta matram amalam
spurat purata maulinam
spurat purata maulinam
Darshanam Shyamam
Tadid Vasasam Achyutam
Angushta Matram Amalam
Angushta Matram Amalam
Purat Purata Maulinam
Purat Purata Maulinam
Divya Darshanam Shyamam
Divya Darshanam Shyamam
Tadid Vasasam Achyutam
Tadid Vasasam Achyutam
Angushta matram amalam
Angushta matram amalam
Spurat puruta maulinam
Spurat puruta maulinam
Apivya darshanam swamam
Apivya darshanam swamam
Tadit vasasam achyutam
Tadit vasasam achyutam
Vaishnavis
Angushta matram amalam
Angushta matram amalam
Purat
Purat Maulinam.
You type praying, you're going to chant. Angushta, by the measure of a thumb. Matram, only. Amalam, transcendental. Spurat, blazing. Purata, gold. Molinam, helmet. Apivya, very beautiful. Darshanam, to look at. Samam, blackish. Tadit, lightning. Vasasam, clothing. Achutam, the infallible. The Lord. Translation. He, the Lord, was only thumb high, but he was all transcendental. He had a very beautiful, blackish, infallible body, and he wore a dress of lightning yellow and a helmet of blazing gold. Thus he was seen by the child. Text 9. The Lord was enriched with four hands, earrings of molten gold, and eyes blood red with fury. As he loitered about, his club constantly encircled him like a shooting star. Purport. It is said in the Brahma Sanhita, chapter 5, that the Supreme Lord Govinda, by his one plenary portion, enters into the halo of the universe and distributes himself as Paramatma, or the Supersoul, not only within the heart of every living being, but also within every atom of the material elements. Thus the Lord is all-pervading by his inconceivable potency, and thus he entered the womb of Uttara to save his beloved devotee, Maharaj Parikshit. In the Bhagavad Gita 9:31, the Lord assured everyone that his devotees are never to be vanquished. No one can kill a devotee of the Lord because he is protected by the Lord, and no one can save a person whom the Lord desires to kill. The Lord is all-powerful, and therefore he can both save and kill as he likes. He became visible to his devotee, Maharaj Parikshit, even in that awkward position in the womb of his mother, in a shape just suitable for his vision. The Lord can become bigger than thousands of universes and can become smaller than an atom at the same time. Merciful as he is, he becomes just suitable to the vision of a limited living being because he is unlimited. He is not limited by any measurement of our calculation. He can become bigger than what we can think of, and he can become smaller than what we can conceive. But in all circumstances, he is the same all-powerful Lord. There is no difference between the thumb-like Vishnu in the womb of Uttara and the full-fledged Narayan in the Vaikuntha Dham, the kingdom of Godhead. He accepts the form of Archa-Vigraha, worshipful deity, just to accept service from his different, incapable devotees. By the mercy of the Archa-Vigraha, the form of the Lord in material elements, the devotees who are in the material world can easily approach the Lord, although he is not conceivable by the material senses. The Archa-Vigraha is therefore an all spiritual form of the Lord to be perceived by the material devotees. Such an Archa-Vigraha of the Lord is never to be considered material. There is no difference between matter and spirit for the Lord, although there is a gulf of difference between the two in the case of the conditioned living being. For the Lord, there is nothing but spiritual existence. And similarly, there is nothing except spiritual existence for the pure devotee of the Lord in his intimate relation with the Lord. Om Ganatimidandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militanyena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadara Sri Gaur Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. We are hearing about the birth of Emperor Bridget. As stated in the beginning of this chapter, the sages at Naimisharanya had inquired about the appearance of Bridget Maharaj in this world quite a while back in the Bhagavatam. And before Sutta Goswami got around to specifically the birth of Emperor Bridget, other topics were covered. There was Ashvatthama's atrocities. There was the prayers by Queen Kunti. There was Bhishma Dev's departure from this world. There was Krishna's departure from Hastinapur. There was Krishna's entrance into Dwarka. And then we come to the present point in Bhagavatam. Why is the Bhagavatam like this? Chronological order, as we conceive of it, is not followed by the Bhagavatam, as you may have noted. The Bhagavatam is not locked into a linear conception of time. This linear conception of time greatly influences Western thought, Western paradigms, because so much of it is based on Christianity, in which Christ appeared and then everything is progressing in a line towards the point when Christ is to appear again. So much of Western vision and thinking is framed by that paradigm. You go from point A to point B, and things are constantly improving as you get from A to B, in that even if you say the world is going to pieces, still at least you know that at point B, Jesus will come again. So consciously or unconsciously, this assumption is there in Western thought. Look at economics. Look at the conception of technological progress. Things are constantly improving. Mankind is getting smarter and smarter. The problems are there, but mankind is becoming more and more expert. Just see how more advanced human beings are now than they were just 100 years ago. Although you go back into the 19th century, in the 1800s, you'll find some astonishing facts. There were no dentists, yet people somehow other survived. There were no psychologists, and yet somehow other people survived. Nevertheless, things are more advanced now than ever before. Just look what's in your home, look at the technological gadgets, and you can understand how human beings are constantly progressing, certainly as compared to their backwards, barbaric predecessors. Never mind that more people died in wars in the 20th century than all the previous 19 centuries combined. Still, mankind is advancing. After all, there is the United Nations. So, in my travels around the world, I basically deal with four or five basic myths, which I try to alert people to. Myth number one, money brings happiness. Myth number two, technology brings well-being. I know this is Silicon Valley, sorry. Myth number three, weapons bring security. That's where half your federal government's revenue goes towards. And myth number four, the earth provides unlimited resources. and unlimited room for disposal of waste after you exploit those resources. So these four myths dominate human society to the extent that people think that's life. This is the way it is. So therefore, they have this idea, like just like, let's compare the iPod that first came out to the iPod we have now. Can't you see human beings are advancing? Look at the latest MacBook Air as compared to just last year or 2 years ago. Can't you see progress? Do you have the latest version of the iPhone? How about that new operating system? Multitasking. Can't you see? It's obvious. Progress. People are molded now by that conception that just as version 2.0 is more advanced than version 1.89, similarly, human society has to be in some way, in spite of problems, it has to be more advanced than a couple of years ago. What to speak of 1,000 years ago? What to speak of? What do you Krishnas talk about? 5,000 years ago? First of all, who knows what happened 5,000 years ago? Secondly, even if we did know, we are sure that everything was barbaric. So, this is the linear conception of time. Things move from point A to point B. That's all you have to understand. Whereas what vision does the Bhagavatam present? Cyclic time. Things go from point A to point B and back to point A again. And up to point B and back to point A again. So the vision of the Vedic seers, including the Bhagavatam seers, is that why get so caught up about trying to get chronology correct when things are just moving in a cycle anyway? It's like you're riding on a carousel, a merry-go-round. So the merry-go-round turns. Only a fool would think that you're progressing, because sooner or later the merry-go-round is going to be back where it's going to carry you back to where you started. So why get hung up on chronology? I don't know about education in India, but at least when I went to school in the USA, you had to memorize dates. They do that in India or no? Dates for independence when the British withdrew. Dates for what else? Yes. Date when, huh? All the wars? All the wars in India that were fought, yes. Uh-huh. Dates when the nuclear bomb was developed? They don't do that one, though. So, similarly in the USA, in the school system, 1492, Columbus discovered America. Even though Indians were already there, Native American Indians were already there, he discovered America. Of course, what do you have here? 1849, the gold rush in this area. 1776, the Constitution. So why aren't the Vedas fixated upon these notions? Once again, because everything is cyclic, moving in cycles. So since things are moving in cycles and what goes around comes around, and better than focusing on chronology is to focus on the qualities of the persons who are riding on the merry-go-round, riding on the carousel. That is what is noteworthy. Mm-hmm. Why pay so much attention to exact chronological order when everything is moving in cycles? All of material existence is a cycle. Samsara, the cycle of repeated birth and death. So what we need to focus on, the Vedic seers imply, are extraordinary qualities and extraordinary events done by persons with extraordinary qualities, because it's natural. Those with extraordinary qualities will do extraordinary events. So let's focus upon that. That is what is noteworthy. Not getting it all right, you know, that there was this and there was that and then there was that. Of course, especially when you're dealing with Krishna and Krishna's pure devotees who are beyond the clutches of time, as we heard in the purport. For the Lord, there is nothing but spiritual existence. And similarly, there is nothing except spiritual existence for the pure devotee of the Lord in his intimate relation with the Lord. Another reason why things seem to jump around in the Bhagavatam is that these devotees often are speaking in ecstasy. The Bhagavatam is a series of nested dialogues. So you'll have Sutta relaying what he heard from Shukadev Goswami, and then you'll have dialogues between like Uddhava and Maitreya and this one and that one. And within these nested dialogues, transcendental ecstasy breaks out. And so things take a sudden swerve in an apparently diverted direction. But from the viewpoint of devotional ecstasy, it's not a diversion. It's not that the speaker got distracted or got lost. Ecstasy, spiritual ecstasy in serving Krishna, in hearing about Krishna, in distributing Krishna's glories. Spiritual ecstasy is a fact of life. So that's the glory of the Bhagavatam. It presents to you spiritual ecstasy as a part of the fabric of daily life. Things happen because of devotional ecstasy. And so there it is recorded in the Bhagavatam. What happens when ecstasy strikes the speakers? Just like when you read about Uddhava. He's discussing in the third canto of Bhagavatam. And the questions he's asked just cause him to be stunned. And while thinking about the questions about Krishna, he actually just enters into Galoka. And and after a while, his consciousness returns. Not that he was not Galoka conscious before the question, but just because the pure devotee of the stature of Uddhava exists simultaneously in the spiritual world and the material world. So sometimes the ecstasies take a sudden swerve and he loses track of the material world and just dwells, his consciousness is just completely absorbed in the spiritual world. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, Srila Prabhupada explains that for the dear devotee of the Lord, even when he leaves the spiritual world to do a mission in the material world, he's always enjoying his relationship with the Lord at every moment. I was discussing with Vaisheshika Prabhu yesterday about Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur and reading his biography so wonderfully prepared by His Holiness Bhakti Vikas Maharaj. You can indeed see why Srila Prabhupada said he was a Vaikuntha man. What else can I say? You can see our heritage. You can see Srila Prabhupada, also a Vaikuntha man. You see how they, shall we say, adapted to earth life. They were both aliens of the highest order. So when you put 1 + 1 together, I mean, we know Srila Prabhupada's biography. But then you add to it some understanding of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and you see, wow, Krishna is true to his word. Yada yada hidharmasya glanir bhavati. Whenever and wherever there's a decline in dharma, I come. Krishna comes, himself or he sends his dear devotee. I was speaking with His Grace Rameshwar Prabhu in Los Angeles, and he was relaying to me his conversations with Srila Prabhupada in 1977. And Srila Prabhupada was explaining that this Hare Krishna movement is an incarnation of Krishna. Just like Krishna comes to deliver the devotees and annihilate the demons, similarly the Hare Krishna movement, as his incarnation, will do the same. So Prabhupada was delineating that there are two demons that the Hare Krishna movement especially focuses upon relieving the earth of their presence. Godless communism and atheistic science, materialistic science. So, it's natural that when Krishna sends his Vaikuntha representatives, they take up that same mission of Krishna. And it's exhilarating for devotees to see, to realize what we're actually dealing with in terms of our the legacy that we've inherited and the players on the field that we're serving under. It's just stunning. I was telling Vaisheshika Prabhu an example that at that time in the Gaudiya Math, when Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur's mission had just covered India and was shaking all of India. Such a powerful effect of organized printing and distribution of literatures. You know how Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur had the printing press right in the temple room, right in the temple, and it was like part of the deity was there, the printing press was there. And they were publishing like 4 or 5 newspapers. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur published some of his own books, like his commentary on Chaitanya Bhagavat. But he, in terms of books, it seems that he mostly focused upon printing books by his father, Srila Bhakti Vinod Thakur. And it's amazing, just see. He, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he's a Vaikuntha man. Bhakti Vinod Thakur prayed, "Send me a ray of Vishnu, my Lord, to expand the mission that I've developed as a seed." And here's Vaikuntha man, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and he's devoted to distributing his father's books. So, but also, they printed like 4 or 5 newspapers, and Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur would express to his disciples, "You study these newspapers, in there you'll find the party line, the transcendental party line." Because there, either through articles Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur wrote himself or had his disciples write under his direction, and everyone knew, everyone could understand. Although, you know, he didn't write this directly. He dictated it. The disciple gave it shape. So everyone knew what was going on. So many articles in The Harmonist were dictated by Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He would give the conception, and everyone could recognize, no one else could think of things like this. There was no doubt. So, there was, at that time, the preaching tactic, it was considered respectable in India to send the Math members out, brahmacharis and sannyasis, going door to door for bhikshu, for collecting alms, which could be anything from food to money. Whatever. So that was, in the beginning of the 20th century in India, that was part of the culture. It wasn't any big thing. So one day, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur overheard one of his disciples saying, I'm a big collector. And actually, Kumaraj really depends on me to get out there and, you know, bring in the resources. So Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvatakura overheard this. And then the next day he made an announcement. All right, I'm going to show you all something. For the next 2 weeks, no one goes out for collecting alms. No one goes out. I will go out one day, and the rest, and then that's it. And no one goes out for 2 weeks. Watch what happens. So Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur went out one day, and no one went out, you know, no one else went out. And for 13 days after that, no one else went out. And devotees just amazed to see so many people coming to the temple, bringing wealth, food. So Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur was showing them, you know, I've got a direct connection to number one. Yeah, I don't really need you all. It's just my mercy. I'm engaging you all. So this is our transcendental heritage. How Krishna gets things done himself directly, as his devotees, through his devotees. Here we are in Bhagavatam, and we're reading about Prichit, who has a job to do on behalf of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As you know, he almost was annihilated in the womb of his mother, Uttara. You would think that Ashwatthama had enough in beheading the five sleeping sons of the Pandavas. And they let him go, disgrace, but they let him go. And here he is striking again. Uttara, she ran to Krishna, calling for Krishna. Calling out to Krishna, ran to him by calling his name. That's the same as running to Krishna. Calling his name. And she selflessly cried out, you'll read in Bhagavatam, I don't mind perishing, but please save the child in my womb. This is a mother's love. That's why the acharyas say that the closest thing you'll get in this world to understanding unconditional love is a mother's love for the child. There's almost no conditions there, but there are conditions, but comparatively speaking to all other relationships, it's the closest thing you can get to understanding unconditional love. Of course, we understand mothers do want appreciation. My mother's always telling me, you were my first child. I put everything I had into you. And then, of course, the next line is inevitable. Why don't you come and stay at home? I taught you how to travel when you were 8 years old. That was my mistake. You became too independent. So that's the condition, that, you know. Mothers want their sons around, and they want to be acknowledged and appreciated. But it's still what they go through in terms of raising a child is it's actually quite austere. Feeding and cleaning the child and being up all night and chanting their rounds at the same time if they're devotees. Life is never the same when a child appears. Instead of you being number one in your life, someone else is number one. And it takes quite some time for couples to realize that. They only have a theoretical conception before. But reality really hits home when the jiva arrives home. And your life is not in your hands anymore. So the mother, an ideal mother, selflessly serves the child. I was speaking in Russia at a festival. I was speaking to an audience, a seminar audience of about 1,200 devotees. And I said, I would like to do some sociological research. I explain this in a book of based on these seminars that some devotees have published called Bhakti Bhava, The Emotions of a Devotee. It's a book meant for devotees, in-house book. So we're speaking about devotee emotions and the emotions of being a servant of Krishna, how that is, that's where it's at. And it's not that we are theoretical or kind of religious beliefy. We are actually expressing the emotions, the bhakti bhava of being a servant of Krishna. So I was giving various examples of life in this world as we know it, our social dealings, just so devotees have an understanding that they have emotions, and these emotions are most properly expressed in devotional service in relation to devotees. So somehow there we got on this topic of unconditional love and the example of a mother and child. So I said, let me present one point. Do you know, this is an audience of 1,200, do you know that, and most of them, of course, were married or going to be married. I said, do you know that women like their children better than their husband? And all the men like, oh, how could you say such a thing? I don't know where. I'm number one. I'm the man. They, you know, so, it doesn't look like, you know, in this room of 1,200, it looks like the men are not agreeing and the ladies are all silent, you know, like just moving their eyes like. I said, all right, let's do a survey and please honestly participate. How in this room of 1,200, how many women like their child more than their husband? And almost all the women raised their hands and the men just practically died like. They never realized it. They were like, how can that be? They thought, at least it should be equal. It's just the way material nature works. It's a closer bodily conception. The child comes from the mother's body. And besides, after a while, most ladies realize men, they just do their thing, you know. As long as they provide and bring the things that are necessary for the home. And, of course, if you're fortunate to have a devotionally strong husband, well, that is indeed great fortune. But still, most ladies understand. In terms of men, they just do their thing. They just, sometimes in another universe, in terms of supplying the emotional necessities. But the child, the child is so dependent on mother. The child is, it's clear that the child lives on the nutrient nourishment of the mother and the emotional nourishment. This is why the acharyas explained to us we should chant Hare Krishna in the mood of a child calling for mother. The child knows my only source of nourishment and maintenance, my only source of life is my mother. It was in this mood that Uttara called out to Krishna when Ashwatthama was attacking her womb. I don't mind dying, but please save this child. So she was unselfish. We now get a description of what Pritchett saw in the womb as his body was being attacked. The purports explain that the heat was so intense for that little child in the womb that only because he was a great warrior could he withstand such, tolerate such heat from the Brahmastra. With current photography, you can actually see images of a child in the womb. And scientists have demonstrated that when the mother is around certain kinds of music, the child in the womb actually dances. Certain sounds penetrate the womb more than other sounds. So Pritchett was no ordinary child in the womb, and therefore the Lord personally came to save him. And Pritchett never forgot that sight. Therefore, as you know, he has that name, Pritchett the Seeker. He pursued that supreme person whom he saw in the womb. Now, what exactly did he see? He, the Lord, was only thumb high, but he was all transcendental. That was really an ecstatic statement. He was all transcendental. First of all, how can you saying he's only thumb high? So that's a material measurement. So how can he be all transcendental? Krishna is not subjected to the laws of time or space. Those laws are his insignificant energetic arrangements. Even in the material cosmos, those laws aren't universal. They are residents of higher planets who can violate the laws of time and space. Krishna can appear greater than the greatest, smaller than the smallest. So therefore, although he appeared to Pritchett's vision to be only thumb high, he's all transcendental, meaning he's got nothing to do with measurements. That's why his name is Adokshaja. During Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur's preaching campaigns, he would stress this point, Adokshaja, because it was the most relevant thing for the time. Just like we may stress you're not the body. Well, people back then in India, they understood we're not the body, but they couldn't understand the all transcendence of the Supreme Lord. So Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur would stress the point, Adokshaja, you can't measure him. You can't calculate him. And he would also stress the point that of the difference between the seer and the seen. We are not the seers. We are seen by the Lord. And that means we want to act in such a way that the Lord is seeing us properly, in that we're acting for his pleasure. When you think that you're the seer, I will come and see the deity. It's with a spirit, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur point out, of enjoying. The deity exists for my pleasure. I will come before the deity and see the deity, so I will feel better. My eyes will be gratified. In one way, there's nothing wrong with that, but Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur was always illuminating the pure devotional principle. So he says, when you come before the deity, the deity is seeing me. Have I done something worthwhile that the deity should notice me? So he just turned the tables. It's the deity that's having the darshan of you. And are you up to scratch? Can you pass muster? Just think about it. It's actually quite revolutionary. He just turned the tables. We just think, I want to see Krishna for my pleasure. Oh, how does Krishna look for my pleasure? Will Krishna look up? Will Krishna smile at me for my pleasure? Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur explained, when you go before the deity, think, are you worthwhile to be seen by the deity? Are you doing anything that the deity should take note of? Are you doing worthwhile service that the deity should take notice of you? So, in other words, define your life in terms of Krishna seeing you. Not trying to impose your vision on Krishna. Krishna, I want to see you. Evidently, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur even took an issue, so to speak, because he's just illuminating the higher levels of pure bhakti. He says, what is this Jagannath Swami Nayana Pantagami Bhava to me? This is Karmakanda. This is fruit of activity. Lord of the universe, kindly be visible unto me. Why don't you do something that the Lord will look at you? Do some service that will catch Krishna's attention. So the Lord appeared to Pritchett, apparently only thumb high, but he was all transcendental.
He had a very beautiful, blackish, infallible body. This is another point, the infallible body. Generally, we think, well, all the bodies I know are fallible, so therefore, how can I think of God having a form? This point is so deeply ingrained in human society these days. When I think of God, I cannot think of a form because a form is fallible. That's our unconscious, unstated, implicit assumption. A form has limitation. A form decays. So then, just like by your reading, the Brahma Samhita prayers, you really just get a handle on how the Lord, the Supreme Controller, has an all-blissful spiritual body, the cause of all causes. That is very important, because then, as you hear the descriptions of the Lord, you won't impose your material assumptions. He wore a dress of lightning yellow and a helmet of blazing gold. Thus he was seen by the child. And in the next verse, we hear a further description. The Lord was enriched with four hands, earrings of molten gold, and eyes blood red with fury. As he loitered about, his club constantly encircled him like a shooting star. This is all going on outside the realm of time and space. You're dealing with Pritchett's viewing something that has nothing to do with material phenomena. So the Bhagavatam is preparing you to accept that reality. Mother Yashoda had to deal with this reality several times. Krishna's her child. But what kind of child is this? What happened when little Krishna, accompanied by Balaram as little boys who were crawling around Vrindavan, what happened when they would do mischief? The older gopis of Vrindavan, they would relish coming to Mother Yashoda and giving the reports what your child is up to. This is their Sankirtan in Braj. We're getting so much bliss watching little Krishna do mischief. We should include Yashoda Mai in on this bliss. So that's why they went to present the reports. They didn't want her to miss out. This is Sankirtan in Braj. They would tell, you know what your child does? He goes to all the houses and lets loose the calves. So the calves start drinking all the milk from the cows. And while we're scrambling, trying to save our milk supply, what does little Krishna do? He enters into our house and begins to steal yogurt and butter. He creates a stampede to distract everyone. And while we're all scrambling, he goes in our house and steals. Or sometimes, without even creating a ruse, he'll just walk right in front of us and mesmerize us with his smile and just steal right in front of us. And he'll bring in his friends. He'll send one of his friends to spy on houses and find out when everyone's gone, when there's a good time to come and steal. And then he'll come with his little friends. And they'll steal. And even if we keep the yogurt in pots hanging high from the ceiling, little Krishna will teach all his friends how to stack things up. And then he'll climb on top of the stack and he'll teach his friends how to pick a hole in the bottom of the yogurt pot. And he'll show them personally how to open your mouth and let the yogurt stream down. And then the older gopis will say that, well, it's not, we realize it's not actually that he's hungry, it's that he just likes to steal. Because Mother Yashoda would naturally think, well, there's something wrong with the milk products in my home. So they pointed out to her, you know, he's not hungry. He just likes to be a thief. And if he can't find any milk products, nothing to steal, he and Balaram will come into the mandap, the auspicious yajna area of the home, and they'll pass stool and urine on the floor. You see, this is the god you worship. This is the Govinda Madhi Pujam Tamamajavi. How will you explain this? So, what else does little Krishna do? If another tactic he has, if he can't find anything to steal, he tells the residents, he promises terrorism. All right, just wait. When I come back tomorrow, if there's no milk products in this house, I'm bringing a fiery coal in my hand and I'm burning the house down. So, this is the report given by the elder gopis of Vrindavan to include Mother Yashoda in on the bliss. And Mother Yashoda is happy because she's thinking, I want everyone to feel the joy that I have with Krishna. I want them to feel that they have a bond with Krishna. Similarly, Nanda Maharaj, when the cowherd men, after the lifting of Govardhan Hill, came to him to speculate, who is this Krishna? Nanda Maharaj, he didn't reply to them, my son Krishna, or Garga Rishi told me about my son Krishna. No, he referred to our boy Krishna, because he wanted to include them in. He wanted to increase the bliss by being inclusive. Let's all feel that we're related to Krishna. This is Sankirtan. Let's include everyone. We're feeling nourishment from bhakti, so we're concerned. What about the others? Are they feeling nourishment from bhakti? Well, this is Sankirtan in Braj. So this complaining about Krishna would go on. Not really complaining, but the gopis, the elder gopis, would pretend they're complaining. But they were getting pleasure out of chanting about Krishna. And Mother Yashoda was getting pleasure that they were getting pleasure chanting about Krishna, enumerating his pastimes. And then Mother Yashoda would look at little Krishna who was right there, and he would give her a fearful expression and mesmerize everyone and arouse everyone's sympathy. Oh, we don't want to complain too much. And as you know, Mother Yashoda would say, well, maybe if I take his jewels away, he won't be able to see in the dark for finding things to steal. And the elder gopis would say, well, that won't do any good. If you take all his jewels away, his body glows and he'll still see in the dark. So, we switch from the older gopis giving their reports about Krishna to the cowherd boys, the little cowherd boys giving reports about Krishna. They went to Mother Yashoda and said, little Krishna has eaten dirt. So Mother Yashoda took this very seriously. Krishna, now, these are your friends. They're saying like this. And even Balaram is saying like this. In other words, I don't know how you're going to wiggle out of this one. These are your own playmates. So, Krishna, his defense was that they're just mad at me that I didn't want to play with them any longer, and so therefore they, including my brother, are making up these stories. So, actually, who was lying in this story is in this Leela is not important. Was Krishna lying? Were the cowherd boys lying? The fact is, as the acharyas explained, that Krishna was in relishing the childhood propensity of lying. I didn't do anything. They're all just making up stories. He was relishing that childlike behavior. And he was also giving, of course, his mother a chance to relish that childlike behavior. Oh, my son is telling a lie. It's part of the Ananda Kund, the pool of liquid ecstasy that we sing about in Dhammadrastika. Iti driksa lila bi Ananda Kund. From Krishna's own personal stock of pastimes, Swalila, he drowned the residents of Vrindavan in pools of liquid ecstasy. So this is one of them, his own personal private stock of pastimes, lying. I didn't do anything. So Mother Yashoda gave the appropriate motherly response. All right, why don't we just settle this matter once and for all? Open your mouth and I'll look in. And when she opened her mouth, you know what she saw. She saw the entire universe with all its components. She saw herself and Krishna. Now, in other words, Krishna was, so to speak, we would say, they blowing her mind. But he did it in such a way that her maternal feelings of Vatsalya Prem were not jeopardized. So while her mind is blown, seeing the whole universe in the belly of Krishna, not exactly in the mouth, but she looked through the mouth and saw in his belly the whole universe, she's still feeling like, this is my son. What's going on with my son? What's going on with me as a mother? This is what makes the pastime so juicy. So she begins to philosophically speculate. Every once in a while, Krishna's yogamaya potency allows philosophical speculation to go on in Vrindavan as to what is Krishna's identity. Just like after the lifting of Govardhan Hill, the cowherd man began to, who is he? On the one hand, he lifted Govardhan Hill, but on the other hand, we see he cries, he does mischief, he lies. So, I don't know, what kind of person is he? He can't be God because he's crying, he does mischief, and he plays around like a little child. On the other hand, we've seen he lifted Govardhan Hill. Of course, you'll read in Nectar of Devotion how Mother Yashoda later will have her own understanding of how Govardhan Hill went in, was lifted. Actually, Nanda Maharaj did it. And how did the Yamala Arjun trees collapse? Strong wind. Because after all, Krishna's her boy. So similarly, she's looking into the mouth and down into the abdomen, the belly of Krishna, and she sees the entire universe. And she starts, what's going on here? It's my child, but I'm seeing these things. To put those two facts together was like, it was just too much. Am I dreaming? No, I can't be dreaming because I'm awake. It's obvious I'm awake. Am I deranged? Have I been hit with some kind of mental disease? No. Everyone knows I'm in good health. Or maybe the demigods are trying to play with me in some way to bewilder me. But I'm just an insignificant woman, housewife. What would the demigods want? Why would they want to waste time with me? Finally, she concluded, this is an extraordinary mystic display of my son. She would never let go of that reality of my son. It's my son. And after all, Gargarishi said he would be different. He would be like Narayan. So maybe this is what it's like to have a child, my son, who's like Narayan, my son. So she just says, her consciousness was just tottering. So Krishna let that go on for a while. But then he, with his yoga maya potency, he made the Vatsalya Prem more intense so that she would just drop her speculations. Because she was starting to offer prayers to Narayan. Let me offer my obeisances to the Supreme Absolute Truth, who has an illusory energy. And by that illusory energy's influence, I'm thinking I'm the queen of Vrindavan. Nanda Maharaj is my husband. All the wealth of Vrindavan is mine. And Krishna is my little boy. It's all by the arrangement of illusory energy that I'm attached to all these bodily affairs and possessions. She's praying to Narayan. In other words, she's turning to Narayan for relief. I mean, what to do about my little boy? I'm seeing these things. He's my boy. Maybe Narayan can help. I pray to you. I offer my obeisances. Please free me from the bodily conception of life so I can better be a mother for my boy. That's when Krishna thickened the curtain of Yoga Maya, and she dropped all those fine philosophical speculations, and she began to mother Krishna. Lord Brahma refers to this event in his prayers after the Brahma Vimohana Leela, the bewilderment of Lord Brahma. He refers to Krishna's revealing the whole universe in his abdomen. And Lord Brahma makes some very interesting points about the body of Krishna, because these verses are about the body of the Lord, the very beautiful, blackish, infallible body, the Sham body. Lord Brahma says, I can't understand your body, even though I'm Brahma. If I can't understand your body, how can I understand the happiness that you're experiencing? And then Brahma began to refer to himself. Who am I? I'm just a tiny creature dwelling in a pot-like universe. And who are you? Countless universes emanate from the pores of your body. This is Brahma putting things into perspective. And then he began to beg forgiveness from Krishna. He said, just like a mother is not disturbed by the baby kicking within her womb, similarly, please don't be disturbed with me. Because actually everything, real or unreal, in other words, temporary or eternal, is within your purview. In that sense, Brahma's pointing out, you are the mother and everything is your womb because they're all your energies. And we're within your energies. So in that sense, everyone and everything is within the womb of Krishna, the mother. And that means I'm also within the womb and that I kicked a little bit. Please overlook that. So in this way, Lord Brahma comments about the inconceivable appearance of the Lord who seems to have bodily measurement when actually he doesn't. So we were talking about Śrīla Bhaktisiddhānta Sarasvatī Thakura, how he would always emphasize this adokṣaja point. Mother Yashoda again encountered adokṣaja when she tried to bind Krishna. You know what happened. She put down the stick. Why? Because Krishna was putting on such a show of being frightened. Krishna was determined. She's not going to punish me. And Mother Yashoda had Krishna by one hand and the stick in the other. And Krishna was shaking. His pearl necklaces were shaking. He was sobbing. He was rubbing his eyes and the mascara was running. Oh, such a beautiful sight. The acharyas say he's telling Mother Yashoda, please, don't hit me, don't hit me. And Mother Yashoda is saying, if you're so afraid of my stick, why then are you doing mischief? And Krishna is saying, I won't do it again. I won't do it again. Just put the stick down. Put the stick down. He's maneuvering. He's going to get out of this one. And he did. Mother Yashoda began to consider child psychology. It's not very good child psychology if the child is too afraid of the mother. So she put the stick down. But then she considered, but he's so restless. He may just run out into the forest and get in trouble. I've got to bind him. That way I can do some household chores, which are all meant for his pleasure anyway. I'll bind him, and that way there can be some peace at home. So she went to, as you know, get the ropes to bind him. Yeah, of course, Krishna's waist, from ordinary point of view, was so tiny. What's the big deal about getting a rope around his waist? He's a little boy. Mother Yashoda tried to get the rope out around his waist, around the waist of a Dokshaja, who has no beginning or end, no middle. How do you get a rope around someone who has no beginning or end? No middle. Who can't be measured. But she tried. As you know, the rope was 2 fingers short. She got another rope, tied it to that one. Another rope, tied it to that one. Always a gap of 2 fingers. She wasn't going to give up. The elder gopis were watching, and they were smiling. Ooh, this child is different. We don't know if you're going to be able to bind him. And what was Mother Yashoda's determination? I don't care if I have to stay here all day until the evening, getting rope after rope. I will bind my child because I am responsible for him. I will discipline him. I will raise him properly. This is Mother Yashoda's determination. The acharyas call it bhakta nishta, the fixity and purpose of a devotee. But Krishna had his own nishta, swanishta. And Krishna's thinking, I don't want to be bound. I have more mischief to do with my playmates. But then he saw Mother Yashoda's bhakti nishta, the transcendental perspiration on her face, the flowers falling from her hair as she labored to bind him. And so then Krishna agreed, all right, let my opulence potency go in the background and be superseded. Let it be superseded by sweetness. So that's what happened. Why the 2 fingers gap? 1 finger gap is represented by Mother Yashoda's determination as a devotee. The other finger's gap is represented by Krishna's own determination to do his own thing. But then, ultimately, Krishna succumbed to the devotee's determination to love him and care for him in Vatsalya Prem. So those 2 nishtas combined when Krishna wanted to, and then Krishna was bound. Bhakti Bhadam, not exactly by the rope, but by his mother's bhakti. So she had to deal with this Krishna who has no size limit. When she looked down Krishna's mouth into his abdomen and saw the whole universe, when she tried to bind Krishna with a rope, a simile, Pritchett is seeing someone who looks only a thumb high, but as we're carefully told, that person is all transcendental with an infallible body. All right, we'll stop here. Any questions? I didn't think I was going to get this far. I told Vaishyashekhar Prabhu, class till 10 o'clock? Oh, that's not possible. But due to his presence and your presence and the presence of Bhagavatam, things happen. Yes.
You were talking much earlier about money doesn't buy happiness. And I completely understand that.
And do you know the second part of that? Money can't buy everything, but what it can't buy, it can rent. That's a materialist mantra. We agree, money can't buy everything, but what it can buy, it sure can rent.
Well, that could fix a little bit what I was saying then.
the world does work with money in it. And when we do have money, we're able to travel and give to those who are helping us travel mm-hmm. and take air flights. Mm-hmm. And we do become more exposed versus, you know, just being in, we're not meant to be in just one spot and so humble that we're just poor with nothing. And, but yet then money is something that is shared to help us do other things in our lives and become enriched. How do you balance that? That's just something you have to work on with discipline, not to get thinking, I need more, I need less.
I need money for Krishna. Okay. And whatever Krishna sends. How do you know that Krishna sent the money? In that while you're endeavoring to get money, you don't lose your Krishna consciousness or risk your Krishna consciousness. Then you can say, Krishna's sending it. But as soon as you try to act for money in a way that jeopardizes your spiritual development, then that's your thing. But if you're just legitimately and honestly pursuing your occupation, in a way that whether Krishna sends you millions or sends you a few dollars, you don't jeopardize your bhakti, then you can say, I'm depending on Krishna. So, and for Krishna, it's not the millions or the few dollars, it's all about the bhakti. He takes the essence of the devotee's loving situation. So someone can be very poor and be an extraordinary devotee, and someone can be very wealthy and be an extraordinary devotee. Krishna's looking at the bhakti, the loving devotion. So, yes, everyone has to work in this world. You know, even sannyasis, you know, they have to work in the sense that they have to do something. Traveling is hard work. So you should, this is the advice that I give at business schools when I'm speaking. You should go to work not to get, but in order to give. First of all, in order to give yourself a bhakti lifestyle. It's like my Sheshika Prabhu has his bhakti life program. Work to give yourself a bhakti lifestyle and to give your family a bhakti lifestyle, and according to your resources, work to give as many people in the world as you can a bhakti lifestyle. That's why you go to work. Spend money for Krishna's pleasure. Keep Krishna in the center of your home. Spend money for that according to your means. How do you know what your means is? The endeavor doesn't jeopardize the growth of your bhakti. Spend money to provide a spiritual bhakti culture for your family members. And spend money to help others, to help the mission of distributing Krishna consciousness to the world. That's going to work in order to give. But when you think, I'm going to work because soon I can get this and I can get that, and I can go here, and I can go there, and that becomes very unenlivening. The selfish life is not very enlivening.
So I guess my question too then was, where, how you're making a momentum to keep it unselfish, to keep that going and not be stagnant in your thinking or in your place, and you're kind of
go
going
to work
with it.
To give. Simple as that. Give bhakti to a lifestyle to yourself. Give it to your family. And then as many persons as possible, as your resources allow. Everyone can give a little something to give bhakti to others, and some can give much more.
Often when it doesn't come as quickly or as much as you know that you want to give, you know it's in your heart, that's something in yourself.
That's depending on Krishna.
And don't try and analyze it too much.
You may want it. Oh, Krishna, send me $1 million. I could make all of San Jose Krishna conscious. Okay.
It's very purifying. That's
yeah,
all.
Okay. If it comes, wonderful. I don't think anyone here will criticize. But if it doesn't come, wonderful, because you're chanting Hare Krishna. You're helping with the outreach activities here.
So it's still the higher consciousness that you're holding. You're holding higher consciousness when you do, when money is around, it's really not there if you're having it for selfish means. It's really only there if you're holding a higher consciousness to give.
It's Krishna's money. Just like Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur sings. Your leader and temple is very fond of the songs of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He says, Krishna, in one of his songs, he says, Krishna, I will certainly earn money to support your family. I will be like a dog outside the house guarding your family. So therefore, when he would perform arti at home, Shuddha Bhakata Charanam, he would see his whole house turn into Vaikuntha. He's showing the perfectional possibilities of home life.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Yes.
Just again referring to the same question that she asked, how can we, I mean, if I say I'm going to earn money to support my family, how do I know that the real motive is to serve Krishna there, or real motive is just to take care of our family for our own selfish desires, for our own selfish way of living?
Well, look at how look and see how the money is being spent.
But sometimes, you know, if I have to take care of this family, then why only that family? Like, there are so many families in the world.
Exactly. But still, as a householder, you have to take care of your family. Otherwise, as always, is the brahmacharya. I was telling Vaisheshika Prabhu, another example from the life of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He was very heavy against mundane welfare work. He would say, someone would come to him presenting a plan for doing material welfare work, building an ashram for the blind, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur would start off very gently for a few sentences. It's, your plan is high, your plan is noble. But, and then he would just slash the whole thing to pieces. And his point was that material welfare work is deception because you're distracting people's attention from what is the real problem, and you're bringing their attention to something else, and you're giving them an illusory feeling that they've made progress, that things are better, when actually the real problem hasn't been touched. So you are being deceptive. He would make this point. What did he say in the Harmonist? He said, thousands of welfare workers and thousands of gyanis trying to merge into Brahman, their activities cannot compare to a Kanishta Adhikari, a third-class devotee, neophyte devotee, going before the deity and one time ringing the bell. So, yet, at the same time, he and his sannyasis, they would give a few paisa, a few cents to beggars. And if he found out that householders were not giving anything to help the poor, he would criticize them. He said, I know what you're thinking. You're not giving any money to the poor because you say it's karma kanda. And therefore, you're keeping all the money for your illusory worship of Radha and Krishna at home. I know what you're doing. You think it's all karma kanda to give money to the poor, and you're saving it all for your imaginary Radha Krishna deity worship at home. Don't you know what the Bhagavatam says in the seventh canto? It's the duty of householders to maintain not only their family members, but every creature, not even human, not superhuman, but animals, mice, whatever. And then he said what Vaisheshika Prabhu said was touche. He said, What about your non-devotee relatives and your family? I know you're giving them money. Well, he was too much. So the Gaudiya Math, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur's Gaudiya Math, existed in an it was so dynamic in terms of resources, in terms of activities, in terms of achievements. Yet at the same time, a lot of people felt uncomfortable about them because they just persisted in calling a spade a spade. They persisted in just saying, this is real, this is not real. This is real bhakti, this is not. So countless people would come to Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur and the Gaudiya Math and say, if you would just tone it down, you know, you could really be big. I mean, you're big now. You're the biggest thing going now. But you could be just super if you would just tone it down a bit. Didn't work. So, yes, he reminded householders that you have to give something. He didn't say, you know, write a huge check. But give something to poor people because you're a householder. He said, otherwise, your heart will become hard and you won't be able to worship the deity properly because you'll be so hard-hearted. You're not doing your Grihastha Dharma. Interesting, huh? Yes.
I had a continuing question along the line of mission. You said that devotees in the spiritual world may leave it to come in the material world for a certain mission, and yet they are in relationship with the Lord. They are Vaikuntha personalities. So far as the mission is concerned in the material world, aside from welfare in the material world, as you just said, is a deceptive activity. If there are other activities in the material world where there is, let's say, inquiry in order to understand the truth about the material world, nature, for instance, and the elements and everything, and to bring that out through inquiry, would that constitute as a wasteful activity? I would just bring up one verse from the Ishopanishad, Mantra 11, where it says that only one who can learn the process of nations and that of transcendental knowledge side by side can transcend the influence of repeated birth and death and enjoy the full blessings of immortality. So an inquiry into learning about the material world, the truth about it, not deception, and bringing it out, would that constitute as activity that would eventually lead to spiritual development, or is it a wasteful exercise?
Very nice question, very eloquently put. And as you read in the verse, the answer, side by side. That is the important point. If you're going to study material nature, the important thing to always keep in mind is whose nature is it? Just like if we're going to study your nature, we are always thinking it's your nature. But if we look at material existence, I want to study nature, and we disconnect it in our study from the proprietor, then that is nescience. Side by side. Both Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur and Srila Prabhupada were not shy about analyzing material existence to show the fault. The fault is forgetting Krishna. Just like there was a time in Bhakti Guided magazine in the mid-70s when devotees thought to not make it so, how do we say, what's the right word? Not make it so conclusive, and that it should just be kind of like an icebreaker, a nice pat on the back to stimulate the possibility of future relationships. So Prabhupada ended that by saying, all right, you're pointing out there's this problem, there's that problem, there's this economic problem, there's that political problem, but you're just leaving it at that point. So you have to say what is the solution. And he encouraged his disciples, present how present the faults of material existence in such a way to show that without Krishna, everything fails. Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, he would allow his disciples to read the newspaper every day, and he would have them respond. Prabhupada did this in Mumbai. Giriraj Maharaj was telling me. He would have his disciples read the newspaper, and he would point out, look at this article, write a response to the editor. So he got that from Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. But the whole point was to present the real knowledge that Krishna has given. Just like about Back to God in magazine, Prabhupada gave the mission statement to expose their materialistic ideas as all nonsense and to give the real conclusion as Krishna has taught. That's the mission statement. All right, you want to study about the oil problem. Have we reached the end of the oil supply or not? The whole point of that would be to show without following Krishna's instructions, you can't be successful dealing with material nature. So there's room for that as long as it's side by side. Everyone should use all their talents as scientists, as economists, as whatever. But use those talents to show that without Krishna, life cannot be successful. All right? Everyone's talents can be employed in the Lord's service, as ISKCON Silicon Valley so wonderfully shows. You have IT people, and you have a real technologically advanced yatra. Even though I'm just speaking to a few persons in front of me, millions around the world are listening. Vaisheshika Prabhu has dovetailed beautifully so many multi-level marketing techniques. Yeah, he's taken the Tupperware concept for set distribution. Invite all your friends. The more friends you invite, well, the better it'll be. There's a discount. And there'll also be more joy. So, the BBT is asking him to teach the various BBT divisions about customer service. So he'll be doing that. Yeah. Savas Prabhu in L.A. is going to fly Vaisheshika Prabhu down and teach, you know, things like responding to emails, answering the phone, and making your customers feel like they're customers. So. I'm sure you have so many skills that you're employing in Krishna's service. Accountants. Mothers raise their children to prepare them for Krishna's service. It's like our Gaur Prem and Nitai Prem. They were telling me their son, Krishna Prem. See, it's the Prem family. He entered into medical school about an hour away from here, yes? In Fairfield, yes? And so, and the opening day orientation, they were preparing the med students for what's coming ahead. So it's going to be so hard. It's going to be so intense. If any of you here are following any kind of spiritual path or following any kind of guru, forget it. Drop it now. You'll never succeed because our course of study is so hard. It's so difficult. So immediately, Gaur Prem and Nitai Prem said, we've got to come up there and make sure our son stays on the bhakti path. That's the mother's love. What is this nonsense? If you're following a spiritual path or a guru or a spiritual process, you got to drop it now. You'll never be successful. Now notice, They didn't say no partying and no intoxication and no girlfriends. No, drop your spiritual path. Drop your guru. They didn't say at this university, parties are banned, intoxication is banned, illicit cohabitation is banned. No. That goes on. After every big exam, they just party the whole weekend. And they're inviting Krishna Prem, come on. And the boys are meeting the girls are meeting the boys. University doesn't say anything about that. Just see. So the parents felt it was their duty to Krishna to protect their son, who's newly initiated. So there are so many ways you can use your skills in serving Krishna. Nichai Prem uses her culinary skills to keep her son mesmerized. Keep him focused on the bhakti path. So that's a skill. And then in the process of their being up here, while their son's in his 2 years of academic med school, they've discovered the wonderful enlivening ISKCON Silicon Valley. Yes.
Maharaj, I'm generally mostly, when I do things, I don't know what is to be done or what is not to be done, how to be done. And I feel that, I am always in a state of unhappiness always because, I don't know how to do things or what things to be done, what not to be done. So how do I proceed?
Give me an example. Whether you should chant sitting down or standing up or... Whether you should marry or not marry? Are you married?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so that's already done. So it's a done deal.
Yeah, examples are there, but unfortunately I cannot give in this assembly. Maybe right. I can talk to you personally.
Bhakti requires guidance. As soon as we try to subtract guidance from bhakti, the road becomes bumpy, the seas become choppy. Guidance is an inbuilt feature of bhakti, as Arjuna and Krishna demonstrated in Bhagavad Gita. So the more that you have a community thriving on guidance, the more the clear path of bhakti will be illuminated. All right? Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, thank you for a wonderful class. Maharaj, I just want to ask you, in New Zealand and Australia, you organize so many loft or for Brahmachari ashrams and distributing books in the universities. Can you share experiences, Maharaj? I was in New Zealand for 1 year.
Oh, where? And
in Auckland.
Huh?
And I received first Bhagavatam book from, I think, he's our congregation devotee. His name is Bal Gopal.
Oh, yeah. Bal Gopal?
Yes, Maharaj.
Brahmachari?
Yes, Maharaj.
Yeah, he's still a Brahmachari.
So, and
when he was a little baby, his mother, she was not an initiated devotee. She was a New Zealander. And yet she used to lull him to sleep singing the Hare Krishna mantra. So, obviously, that had some effect.
He told very nice point, Maharaj. He told, here there is a lot of Lakshmi, but no Narayan. So people, he gave me Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavatam book, and he told, these people have a lot of good money, but no Narayan is.
Where did you meet him?
In downtown Auckland. Yeah. I'm going to the temple at that time.
So. All right. Well, I'll tell him that his little service he did has had such great effects.
Thank you, Maharaj.
I'll tell him now you are a dynamic member of the ISKCON Silicon Valley. Doing Herculean tasks according to your measure, according to your capacity. Yes.
You made this point of how do you determine if you're actually, you know, when you're working, if your bhakti is steadily increasing, that means, okay, you are doing the right thing. But what if the work is not the source of your bhakti slowing down? If your work, you know, if your workplace is not the source of, if your occupation is not the source of your bhakti slowing down, but constant movement from here and there.
Well, you're working to get fruits. So what are you doing with the fruits? That is the point. Sometimes workplaces are austere, sometimes they're not. But the main thing is the fruits. How are the fruits being employed for Krishna's pleasure? So jobs have different characteristics, different austerities. Depending on the job market, you have to either tolerate or switch, or that's, but you just have to do the best you can, keeping the goal in mind is that you're supporting a bhakti lifestyle for yourself, for your family, and you want to help as many others as possible. So there'll always be variables in the workplace, but you have to look at the fruits. You're not going to work to have a good time in terms of socializing, and although in the mundane world, people spend more time at work than at home because home is so such problems. They're closer to their workmates than they are to their family members. First of all, they have to work so many hours that they don't see their family members. And secondly, the family has such problems. It's so complicated. You know, you've been through your second or third divorce. You've got children from, you know, several marriages, and it's like it's so complicated. In-laws from this marriage, in-laws from that marriage. This one's grandmother is over in St. Louis. My other child's grandmother is in Alaska, and this is the son of my wife's previous husband. And this is too much. I'll just spend time at work. That's the way it is. Work has become home. Of course, obviously you don't do like that, but still. Look and see who's enjoying the fruits. And then in a workplace that's austere, you can tolerate when you realize what the point of it all is. All right. How are we doing time-wise? Yes.
Maharaj, you mentioned that Parikshit Maharaj had a job to do. Similarly, we have also some job to do as a conditioned soul or jiva soul. And another point you made was that one should act in such a way that Krishna wants to see you. So I feel that I do have enough resources to understand and get engaged in a service properly. However, I do see a lack of determination and sincerity.
You have enough
Resources to get, you know, determination and courage to get engaged in the devotional service or in a welfare activities. However, I felt how do I understand the lack of enough sincerity or get engaged in a proper way?
Of course, any real devotee thinks I'm not sincere enough. And so we associate with devotees to develop our bhakti creeper. The more that we understand the wealth of devotee sangha, the more we make spiritual advancement. Like Vaisheshika Prabhu and I, when we were driving here, he was describing how as long as you're in your comfort zone, you can't make so much spiritual advancement because it's your material niche. But if you just step outside your comfort zone a little bit, you leave yourself open to dependency on Krishna. You leave yourself open for the bhakti shakti. So we need association to enliven us for venturing a little bit out of our comfort zone. Not that someone's going to send you to Afghanistan to preach or something. But we have our conceptions. With those conceptions, we become burdened. I can only do this much. I'm sure you've all heard so many candidates to bhakti explain, how do you ever find time to chant 16 rounds? And then they do it and they realize, I do have much more time than I thought. I just, keep the TV turned off and wow, there's 2 hours I save every day, at least. So we need that association. Just like by association, you all began chanting at least 16 rounds. Whereas at first you thought, how do they do this? Is this really Hinduism? Hinduism means just believe in the gods and leave it at that, these Hare Krishnas are a bit over the top. One man from Delhi who came over to Melbourne, Australia to check on his son who became a devotee. First his son came to study in school in Melbourne and he became a devotee. The mother came to check on him. What's going on with my son? Is he becoming a brahmachari? Because the conception is there. As soon as you touch the japa mala, it means he might become a brahmachari. And so the mother came flying over to check on him and she became a devotee. So then the father, he said, what is going on? My son, now my wife too. Let me fly over and find out what's going on. So he, in the presence of the wife and the son, he began to explain to me, Swamiji, you must understand, the Hinduism is broad. It's not fanatical like Islam. Whether you drink tea or coffee or onions or garlic, that is not the point. The real Hinduism does not focus on these details. Otherwise, we become like Islamic fanatics. And about my son. All right. He's IT now. He has a good job. But if my son, by the time he is 60, if he does not rise... went with his hand. If he does not rise on the corporate ladder and he's at the same position when he's 60, he'll feel very bad. So therefore, my son should simply focus on his economic career. And then, when he's 65, that is the time for Bhagavad Gita. But for now, he must... It was like as if his hand gesture was making the absolute truth. Anyway, now the father is also a devotee. Anything else? Mm-hmm.
In the purport that you discuss, it talks about Krishna, that he distributes himself as Paramatma or Super Soul, not only in the heart of the living entity, but also in every atom in material elements. you mentioned that Krishna is adokshaja, infallible and inconceivable. Does it help to go into a discussion or even to ask whether the form that Krishna is in the atom in the material world, is the same or different from that he is in the living entity? The reason that one brings it up is because the living entity is sentient, whereas an atom in the material world is not sentient as such, as we understand. So Krishna, is he in a different form in the atom as opposed to that in a living entity?
The Shastra tells us the form of the Supersoul. However, Supersoul is present. The Supersoul, as described in the second canto of Bhagavatam, you read about the Lord in the heart. And Paramatma is present in every heart, in every atom. One thing you should understand is that wherever there is the Lord, he's never alone. So he's there also with his associates. That is beyond time and space. First of all, you have to start thinking, well, how does the Lord fit into the every atom? And then how do all his associates fit there too? And these things are outside of our calculating attempts because the Lord's a adokshaja. So that Paramatma is present in everyone's heart and in every atom is described in the Bhagavatam. All right. I thank you all very much for your kind attention. Hare Krishna.